I was supposed to be here in November, and I canceled it. And at the time, I was going to talk about some more esoteric and abstract concepts of VR. And since then, the last 3 months, I spent most of my time doing applications in order to do mission support for 2 space missions, and I will talk about that in a second. So I just last minute, I changed my talk title and the talk that I was going to do in order to talk about something that I've been thinking a lot recently, even though it might be a lot more applied VR than, I guess, what this institute has is used to listening to. And the idea is to actually try to use strong field general relativity in order to, with observations of neutron stars, in order to measure their masses and radii. And I personally care more about measuring, mapping the spacetimes of neutron stars, but there's a very, very large community that cares about the equation of state of neutron stars in nuclear astrophysics. And this talk is going to be how to support that community as opposed to talking about the ZR, potential ZR deviations. A number of people have worked on that project at the University of Arizona. Tim, who is here now, Chi-Kwan Chan was a former graduate student. Michi Babuk is a current graduate student, and Ferial Uzel is another faculty member. And a very, very large number of people that are involved in those 2 upcoming X-ray missions. I will talk both about that in a second. LOFT is a Dutch-Italian X-ray mission that potentially is going to fly in 2022. And NICER is a Goddard Space Flight Center NASA mission that most probably is going to be launched to be put on the International Space Station in 2016. So this is only a couple of years from launch. They're both funded. They both have gone through the one down select. There's 3 missions that this is competing for the final slot. There's 3 missions that this is competing with for the final slot. We're actually going to find out about NICER by the end of the month. The good thing with NICER is that it goes on to, as I will say in a second, it goes on the International Space Station. So it's actually very cheap. You don't have to have a spacecraft. You don't even have to have a rocket because you can just put it together with the food of the astronauts and they bring it up there. So this whole mission costs less than $40 million. 40, which is, peanuts for NASA. Whereas LOFT is in the several hundreds of millions of dollars because it's a standalone spacecraft and you have to put it up there. And some more issues that I will come back in a second. So, as I said, there's a lot of interest in nuclear astrophysics about measuring the masses and radii of neutron stars because neutron stars probe a part of the parameter space of the QCD phase space diagram that is not possible to probe in any other way. And it actually is in a non-perturbative regime, a regime that you cannot just do perturbation expansion away from places where you can measure with neutron scattering data. And the way that you usually show the level of uncertainty is plotting mass versus radius. So this is radii of neutron stars in kilometers and masses in solar masses for different equations of states, for different extrapolations away from, beyond nuclear saturation density. I don't want to go into the details because that's not the point of the talk. But what you see is that various attempts, these are purely nucleonic equations of state, as is this one, even though this is a mean field theory. This is an equation of state that has bosons that at some point become contents. And this is just straight strange up-down quark star. And the width of each one of those predictions gives you an idea within its model what is the uncertainty in the extrapolation away from beyond nuclear saturation density. And the point to see is that we more or less know what neutron stars are expected to look like, 1 to 2 solar masses, 10 to 15 kilometers, but we really do not know in any precision that would be useful, both for astrophysical and nuclear physics reasons, anything more than what I show you right now. And there's many ways that you can make progress. One, for example, is you can try to find the most massive neutron star that you can observe. And when you have a neutron star in orbit around another white dwarf or another star, you can use dynamical measurements to measure the mass of the pulsar. And the one that has the highest mass that known so far is a paper by Demarest et al. That is 1.97 solar masses. And effectively, that kills down all the equations of state that do not cross that limit. But there's pretty much every equation of state, if you tweak the parameters, will cross that limit. And the point in this talk is to try to use the fact to measure the mass and radii of neutron stars, that neutron stars are by far the most compact, in the gravitational sense, objects in the universe. Because if you plot the location of a Schwarzschild horizon in the mass radius diagram, you see that the neutron stars, the surface of a neutron star barely hovers above the corresponding horizon if it were a black hole. And therefore, can we use the strong gravitational effects that one expects around the neutron star to measure their masses and radii. I should say that we're not going completely blind, because during the last 6 or 7 years, there's been a tremendous progress in trying to constrain that parameter space spectroscopically by measuring the total emission out of thermally emitting neutron stars and making models for the atmospheric emission and try to infer from that how big is the surface area of a neutron star. And this is a compilation in a recent review of all the current measurements, both for bright neutron stars and faint neutron stars. And what you see is that they're very big error bars. They're highly correlated error bars. You typically measure, 10, 15% the radius, and you have very little constraint on the mass. But what they do tell us is that most of the measurements point towards relatively low radii, compact neutron stars of the order of 10 kilometers, as opposed to 15 kilometers. But this is not the kind of measurements that are significant enough as of yet to constrain the equation of state. Now, it's not just that we are trying to make this measurement forward, measuring masses and radii of neutron stars, predicting what different equations of states will tell us and try to match them. What we realized relatively recently is the fact that each one of those curves, the predictions of mass and radius for different neutron stars, is actually a one-to-one mapping between the equation of state, pressure as a function of density, and the mass versus radius. And that one-to-one mapping can be inverted relatively efficiently. So if you have any measurement or a number of measurements, you can actually take those measurements and invert them and try to infer what the pressure versus density is for cold matter past nuclear saturation density. And this is the best that has been done so far given those measurements. This is pressure of cold neutron matter or neutron star matter in MeV per cubic Fermi. This is the density in baryons per cubic Fermi. And these are the 3 points and the error bars in between them. This is the best that we know today given the current measurements for what nuclear matter or neutron star matter, how behaves past nuclear saturation density. This point is at twice nuclear saturation density, 4 and 8 times. And this is various predictions from various equations of state. This is where things have been so far, based entirely on astrophysical probes of the surface emission of neutron stars. But we want to do much better. And the reason we want to do much better is that none of these astrophysical probes can actually improve the errors, even if we have better and more accurate measurements. And the reason that is true is that there is intrinsic systematic uncertainties in those spectroscopic measurements of the sizes of the neutron stars that you cannot correct for. So for example, in the case of the spectroscopic measurements, the whole idea is you measure the entire flux out of a neutron star, you know where it is, you have a model for its atmosphere, and then you use it to figure out how big the surface of the neutron star is. That is true as long as the temperature is uniform on the neutron star surface, which is of course never going to be the case. There's going to be an isotropy, and that's going to introduce a variation. Every time you measure the surface over and over, there's going to be a different temperature and isotropy, and that's going to introduce a spread that you don't know how to correct for. And we did a very detailed analysis of several tens of thousands of measurements, those spectroscopic measurements of individual of 10 neutron stars. And this is one of those distributions. This is the effective surface area of the neutron star divided by the distance square, because you need to know where the distance is to convert it to actual radii. And the histogram here is the distribution of values that you measure if you do that measurement over and over and over and over again over the last 15 years of the duration of the last X-ray mission. There's a lot of things that have to do with the mission itself. There is uncertainties because, counting statistics, Poisson noise, and lots of little things like cosmic rays that introduce outliers. And we modeled all of that with Tolgay-Giver, who was a postdoc in Arizona. And what we inferred is that if this is the dashed line, is the underlying distribution of effective surface areas for that particular neutron star, then that can definitely reproduce, given all the systematic uncertainties, the width and the characteristics of the measured distribution of normalizations that we measure. So effectively what it tells you is that even if you understand perfectly your experiment, there is about 10% variation in the inferred surface area of the neutron star that is intrinsic to the source because of temperature and isotropies, and there's nothing you can do about it. So this is one inherent limitation of how well you can measure the radii of neutron stars with that method. The second issue is that, of course, the whole thing depends on how well you calibrate your X-ray emission. because if you cannot measure precisely how many X-ray photons hit your detector, then you cannot really tell how many photons left your neutron star, and that will affect how big you think your neutron star is. And you're going to say, how difficult can it be to calibrate an X-ray detector to within a few percent? Well, the answer is it's extremely simple. You can calibrate it to a much better accuracy on Earth. The problem is that then you put your X-ray detector on practically a hydrogen bomb that goes through the atmosphere and shakes it and rattles it and does all sorts of crazy things to it. And during that time, everything gets out of whack. You know, the relative distances between voltage capacitors goes out of whack. The shapes of the detectors changes because of the acoustic oscillations during the launch and the, putting the satellite in orbit. And what you have to do at the end of the day an in-orbit calibration. And the way that you do in-orbit calibration is you look at the source in the sky that you think it's more or less stable, and the Crab Nebula is one of those X-ray sources, which is known to vary to within a few percent, but not more than that. And then you try to reproduce your, to change the calibration of the instrument in order to make the flux that you observe from that nebula, for example, to be constant. Yeah.
So how do you know the X-ray is
constant? In this particular case, I will come to that in a second. There are two types of sources where you can tell that this is the case. And when it comes to calibration, this is, for example, for one of those satellites, the Ross X-ray Timing Explorer. This is normalization of the spectrum for that constant source, the Crab flux that they were getting at the KeV energy as a function of day in the mission over several thousand days. This is the old calibration, which was not that good. The red is the best new calibration, which is meant to be really good. But what you see is that there is a scatter in the calibration of the source that you think that is constant, which is also to within a few percent, 5 to 10% in the best case scenario. So this is another reason why this particular technique that relies on measuring every single photon that comes from that source is not necessarily optimal, because you can never really tell what the calibration of your detectors are. So instead, what you want to do is you want to use dynamics, right? This is the kind of measurements in astrophysics that we always like. Anything that involves the Kepler problem or propagations in space-times, or, you know, things that you can measure orbiting around, moving around, these are the things that we believe and we can control. And the idea for quite a few years, almost three decades now, has been to use particular neutron stars from which we know, and I will say why we know that, that they have a emission that is very localized on their surface. Not the entire neutron star is emitting, like what we wanted before, but something that we know that it's extremely localized. Because as a neutron star spins, in other ways, as that emission goes around, then what you see is you see the effect of strong field gravitational lensing. And trying to decode that strong field gravitational lensing will tell you not only about the space-time itself, but would also tell you what the mass radius, the mass in the radius of a neutron star is. And a way to see that this is highly lensed, besides the fact that that spot gets a funny shape when it goes behind the neutron star, is that you can see at the same time both poles of the neutron star, right? You see behind the neutron. And this is, at the end of the day, the biggest effect. And as I said, the reason that this is important, that depends on the radius and the mass of the neutron star, is because of gravitational lensing, self-lensing of the emission. When you look at the neutron star, you actually see most of the times behind it. Actually, you see quite a lot behind it. And a way to quantify it is to say, suppose that I'm looking down a neutron star and I ask myself, how far away in angular measure can I see behind from looking straight down the star? If it was a purely Newtonian disk, yes. I will talk about that in a second. What are the sources that do that, and how do we know that it happens? Okay. And that, even though this idea has been there for 30 years, the reason that we can only do it now is because now we know what these sources are and how they are. And I will come to that in a second. So as I said, a way to see why that depends on the mass and radius of the neutron star is one quantitative question to ask is how far back can I look when I look at the neutron star? And if it was a purely Newtonian star, you can look at 90 degrees away from straight down. But as I change the radius to mass ratio of the neutron star, and this is in, you know, G and C equals one and everything, then you go from pretty much 90 degrees would be a Newtonian. As you go closer and closer towards the neutron star becoming within the predictions of the standard equations of state, you see always almost 160, 170 degrees behind the star. And if the star happened to be actually at that ratio of 3.52, then you would see entirely 180 degrees behind the star. So you would see always the entire star. What does that mean? It means that if I have a rotating localized emission, If the star is very Newtonian, then you will see it, you will not, you will see it, you will not. So you will see a very high amplitude of pulsation. If you can see the entire neutron star, the only pulsation that you will see is because of the change in the projected emitted area of the neutron star. Right? You will always see it, but it will have highly suppressed emission. And this is a way to look at it. This is flux that you expect out of a spinning neutron star in arbitrary units. The units don't matter here, as a function of the phase of the pulsation. And if the neutron star has a mass to radius ratio of one, like 1/4, so the radius is 4 times the Schwarzschild radius, you get up and down, and then you lose the spot because it goes behind the neutron star. As the neutron star becomes more relativistic, you start seeing the spot over a wider range, and the amplitude is suppressed. And if you have this magic number here, you actually see the spot, it goes down. And when the spot is exactly behind you, you get an Einstein ring around the neutron star, and you see a very large magnification, which actually will be extremely cool to see most of the emission when the spot is behind you. And the idea is that if you can measure and somehow control the systematics of these pulsation amplitudes of spinning neutron stars, then you should be able to at least measure the mass to radius ratio in gravitational units. Now, this is easier said than done, of course, and as I said, this is something that people have done in the early 80s and said this is a great idea, but there are two issues. One is identifying neutron stars where you know that the emission is highly localized, and the second is dealing with unknown geometric factors. Because what we're really looking for is measuring the amplitude of pulsations, but you can see that I can keep the neutron star exactly the same, and I can change from looking at it from the equator to looking at down the pole, and that will make all the pulsation go away, right? Because no matter if I look down the pole, because of rotational symmetry, no matter what the emission is, as the neutron star rotates, it will give zero amplitude. So by measuring the amplitude, there is a degeneracy between changing geometries, where the emission is on the star and where the observer is with respect to the pole of the star, and changing the compactness of the neutron star. And this, for the longest time, have been considered both of them serious limitations of this potentially theoretical approach, but we now know how to deal with both of them. The first one has to do with astrophysics, and I will come to that in a second. The second one is entirely strong field GR. We can use strong field GR in order to break the degeneracies between geometries. Yes.
So does that need to localize emission due to some part of the neutron star smaller than the other?
Yes. I will come to that. Maybe I should have put that as number one. So in order to talk about that, I will have to talk to you a little bit about the two missions, because the two missions are actually are going to use different types of sources, and those different types of sources have different reasons for doing that. One is the CHIP mission, the inexpensive mission, I shouldn't call it CHIP, NICER, which stands for Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer, and you can see here a little animation. This is meant to be the International Space Station. They're going to put that little thing that looks like one of those old Macintoshes, and it's going to come up and, you know, revert itself and go in place and start looking at pulsars. And just, it's a silicon drift detector in the X-rays between, say, 0.2 and 12 kV. This is the effective area, a couple of thousand centimeters squared, and it's a factor of a few larger than the best European X-ray mission, XNM Newton, that works in those energies, soft X-rays, about of the order of a kV. So by itself is an improvement in X-ray technology. But the biggest thing, the biggest improvement of that mission is that it is based, it is designed specifically for that purpose. So it costs not that much money, so you don't have to make everybody happy. XNM Newton costs many hundreds of millions of dollars. So you try to split the time between various communities. This guy is going to cost $40 million, so you can use it and sit on a source for an entire year, which is the kind of thing that you need to get the county statistics to do that measurement. And the sources that were specifically designed to look for, as we know over the last 10, during the last 10 years, are normal radio pulsars, millisecond radio pulsars, pulsars that are powered by the rotational energy itself, and they're spinning at millisecond spin periods, kilohertz or a few hundred hertz spin frequencies, and this is just a schematic of it. And when you look at those pulsars in the X-rays, you see an X-ray pulsation that was unexpected. Most of those pulsars are emitting in the radio, because most of the emission is either synchrotron or curvature radiation far away from the neutron star. But when you look at it in the X-rays, for many of them, you see a big thermal bump that moves around at the spin frequency of the neutron star, and which is highly localized. And the idea is that what you have is the currents that generate the synchrotron or curvature radiation far out in the magnetosphere at some point return into the neutron star, and they hit those tiny polar caps on the neutron star. And those polar caps is what they emit in the X-rays, because they have temperature of like a few tenths of kV. And when you have those heated polar caps coming in and out of the line of sight, then what you see is a very localized X-ray emission from those polar caps.
Are there more?
The main issue is what causes it, it doesn't really matter. What you see from the pulsation amplitudes and what it is, you have a very high thermal, which you cannot do in the magnetosphere, emission at a fraction of a kV with rather localized area on the surface of the neutrons there. The idea is that it is polar cap emission from return currents, but it really doesn't matter. Right, just from its properties, you know that it's thermal surface emission. But this is not actually the best case scenario, and I will come to that again in a second. This is one of those sources. What is good about those sources is that they're extremely stable clocks. These are by far, some of these millisecond pulses are actually more stable than atomic clocks, which means that when you're sitting on a source for months, you can actually time tag all those photons to better than I had before, 300 nanoseconds, and you can put them in the right place in the pulse phase because they're extremely stable. And of course, that's important because you cannot sit in the space station forever looking at a particular source because the space station every 90 minutes goes around the Earth, right? So you observe, you go, you observe, you go, you observe, you go, and you need to be able to put them in the right place in the pulse phase. With those pulses, you can actually measure over the duration of years, pulse per pulse. You know exactly at what phase and what pulsar it is. Some of those pulsars have known masses. These are some of the sources for which we measure the masses dynamically from the Kepler problem because they're around other stars. And therefore, when you measure the mass to radius ratio, if you know the mass highly accurately to better than 10%, you know the radius to similar accuracy. The problem is, as you said, maybe some of that emission is contaminated by the magnetosphere, you know, some Bremsstrahlung emission in the X-rays. And if you have some DC component in the X-rays, that implies that you will see a suppressed pulsation because of that DC component, which you might believe that it's because of higher compactness of the neutrons there. And perhaps more importantly, when those return currents or whatever it is cause and hit the surface of the neutron star, the hitting is not deep. When the hitting is very deep, you can predict the pattern of the emerging radiation extremely accurately. But when the hitting happens pretty much when the radiation is generated in the presence of very strong magnetic fields, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 Gauss, then the pattern of radiation, the angular distribution of radiation that emerges from the neutron star is not very easy to calculate. So these are good sources for some points of view, but not as good sources for other points of view. But this is the main targets behind NICER. What turns out to be a much, much cleaner case, a much higher possibility of doing that measurement accurately, is something that LOFT, the Large Observatory for X-ray Timing, was designed for. As I said, this is an M-class ESA mission. It's one of the four that was down-selected from 15, and within the next year and a half, it was going to be down-selected again to the final one or two. This is a 10 square meter detector. This is the surface, the effective surface area. It peaks at about 10 kV. It's not down here. The one that I showed you before is that blue line that you can barely see peeking out of the axis. So this is really an enormous detector. And it's actually so big, 10 meters square, that if you look at any rocket, there's no way to fit 10 meters square anywhere in the rocket. So the way they're going to launch it is going to launch folded, and it's going to unfold in orbit. And if you look at the way that it currently looks, this flower-shaped, petal-shaped thing, these are actually the detectors. It's not the solar panels. This is the solar panel. So all of those things are folded down, and after launch, they're going to unlock. And of course, there's a lot of issues because you want to be able to point everything, you know, all those unlocked things in the same point in the sky. This is important technology. When you unlock it, after all the shaking and rattling, you want to make sure that everything is going to be in place. But these are things that a lot of engineers are working on, and thankfully, that's not something that I have to worry about. But the primary targets for LOFT is a different class of neutron stars. These are not pulsars. These are not neutron stars that are believed to have any significant magnetic field, maybe 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7 Gauss or below, but totally useless for, you know, messing up anything. And the reason that we know that these guys are neutron stars is because every now and then they accrete material. And when that material on their surfaces gets buried enough, then the triple alpha reaction becomes important. You have a big thermonuclear flash about a meter deep, the thermonuclear burning a meter deep into the neutron star atmosphere. And the way that you see it, and this is, by the way, from the 1980s satellite EXOSAT, the European satellite, this is the steady state accretion luminosity. This is 200, 400, 800, 1,000, 1,200, sorry, 800, 1,000 pounds per second from that satellite, and then suddenly you see this enormous flash that takes about a second and cools down over 5 to 10, 20 seconds. All the properties of those X-ray bursts are consistent with being thermonuclear flashes on the surface of the neutron stars, and the only way to have a thermonuclear flash on the surface is if it's deep enough, right? Because you want the temperature and the density to be high enough to ignite thermonuclear reactions. So this is an extremely beautiful situation in which we have deep surface and deep emission that propagates to the surface and comes out of the surface of the neutron star. Give me a second. And not only that, but towards the peak of the emission, that emission is a factor of 10 larger than anything else around, or 5. This is actually kind of a windy burst. Yes?
Yeah. Suppose that emission
would be isotropic, or would it be like concentrated? So this is the triple alpha reaction is an unstable reaction. It's like what causes the helium flash in normal stars. So it's going to ignite at some point, and then that ignition is going to propagate all around. So what you would expect when you look at a burst like that and you infer the size of the emitting area is during that initial rise, you would expect to see the spreading front propagate. And when it cools down, you expect to see the entire neutron star cooling down. And recently, I'm really sorry, I don't know why this does not show up that well on this projector. People have started doing that, this spectral analysis of the thermonuclear flashes. And this is the apparent radius, flux divided by temperature to the 4, of the emitting area as a function of the flux of the burst. This increase is the first second. So in the beginning, the flux of the burst increases really rapidly, and the surface area increases extremely rapidly. This is the peak, and this is the cooling that happens pretty much at a constant apparent radius. The measurements, the spectroscopic measurements that I showed you before about the size of a neutron star are all based on these kinds of sources. When you know that it's over a very long time for a neutron star, you know, tens of seconds, the entire emission remains pretty much at constant radius. Now, okay, you're going to say this is one good piece of evidence, but there's more to it, right? If the emission starts by being very highly localized on a spinning neutron star, then you would expect in the beginning to see a very strong pulsation. And when the entire neutron star is covered, you expect the amplitude of the pulsation to go down. And indeed that, this is, by the way, a numerical simulation by Spitkovsky and collaborators about 10 years ago that showed the ignition and the propagation of a burning front on the surface of a neutron star. This is a shallow water calculation on a neutron star. This is how this is where they set it up to ignite. And because of Coriolis forces and effectively R modes, you have the emission spreading out extremely rapidly around the neutron star. No magnetic fields, these are just vorticity lines. There's no evidence for any magnetic field in any of those sources. So if you concentrate in the first fraction of a second at the rise time of that burst, and you see the count rate, the X-ray count rate, and you see this is 5,000 and 10,000 counts per second from the previous satellite. LOFT is going to get at least an order of magnitude more seconds, more counts. Then what you see is that at some frequency, which turns out to be of the order of a few hundred hertz, you see these pulsations. They're called burst oscillations. And again, doesn't show very well. This is a function of time in seconds now. This is the first second of the burst. So the flux goes up, and then it's going to start decaying at a much longer time scale. These are the amplitudes of the pulsations. When the flux is rather small, because the radius, the surface area is rather small, you have a localized emission, you see a 20, 30, 40 sometimes percent amplitude of the oscillation. As the emission spreads onto the neutron star, the flux increases because you have more and more of the neutron star emitting, and the pulsation drops really, really rapidly. I think it's from the astrophysical point of view, it is pretty clear, it's pretty certain that what we see here, what those pulsations are the spin frequencies of the neutron star that you see because of the ignition in a very hot, small spot of thermonuclear burning. When people do that measurement of those frequencies over many, many years, over many, many bursts, they're consistent with being constant. So it's a very stable clock, and the only stable clock that we know there is the spin frequency of the neutron star. Now,
do people understand well enough how this propagation
data? No, not at all. So it introduces two things. One is that if you're going to use the technique that I'm going to talk about, you have to pick it in the very beginning, the first fraction of a second, tenth of a second, when the emission is so small that its exact shape doesn't matter. And I will come to that in a second. And the second thing is, as the emission spreads, the emission also moves on the surface of the neutron star, right, where the peak of the emission is. And if you think of what we measure as the time between peaks of emission, there's going to be a little frequency drift until it asymptotes. And these are things that have been observed. So when you measure, when you try to model those frequency displacements, you can actually measure something about the propagation of the burning front, but that's not something that we care about here. But that's different, right?
So that's certainly a different
mechanism.
Because there's some concern about exactly what frequency we're looking at.
So soft gamma ray repeaters are totally the magnet star. The mechanism, again, is not understood what it is. Perhaps modes onto the neutron star. It's a very different phenomenon. This is extremely clean, and it is obvious what those that the frequency drifts are expected for multiple reasons. But does anybody have a good model to account for them? Not necessarily. You can account for the magnitude, but if it is really the way that the front is propagating onto the neutron star, it's weather at that point, right? But we don't care as long as we stick in the beginning of the burst. So the idea for LOFT is to look at those sources, and they have two very good things to their benefit. One is that they're the brightest X-ray sources in the sky. Compared to the other pulses that I talked to you about, they're 3 and 4 orders of magnitudes brighter. So you get an enormous number of photons. And because there's no magnetic fields and you know pretty much it's deep surface emission, the emerging pattern of radiation is extremely well understood. The problem is that the frequencies drift a little bit, as I said, so you really have a very short amount of time to catch them before they start drifting. And because it's a very short amount of time, you really need to add over many, many bursts, because even though there's 4 orders of magnitude brighter, they only last for a fraction of a second. And the reason that LOFT is so enormous, 10 meters squares, is to get enough counts in that first fraction of a second to reach that goal. So, okay, we identified the sources that we can do it, especially those thermonuclear flash sources, but we still have this annoyance of the geometric factors. And as I said, you can get the same amplitude of oscillations even by changing the compactness of the neutron star or by changing the geometry with which you view it. And more than almost 15 years ago now, Pavlov and Zavlin did the analysis of one of those sources. This is wishful thinking at the time. But these are the two uncles, and as you see, it's totally symmetric, so it doesn't matter which one is which. One is the orientation of the observer with respect to the rotation axis of the neutron star, and the other is the location of the spot with respect to the rotation axis of the neutron star. And these are contours of constant amplitude. And effectively, what it shows you is that it's an extreme degeneracy. For the same mass to radius, you have a whole range of geometries in which you can get the exact same light curve. So this is something that you need to be able to uncover, to reduce, in order to measure masses and radii of neutron stars. But for those particular sources, there's one more problem, which turns out to be a benefit. And that problem is that they're extremely fast spinning. This is a distribution function, cumulative distribution function, number of sources with spin frequency less than a particular number. The blue are known rotation power pulsars, millisecond pulsars. These are the targets for NICER. And the red are the bursters, which are the targets for LOFT. And what you see is that they're between 2 and 600 hertz. So those neutron stars not only spin, but they actually spin close, like half, a third of their maximum possible spin frequency.
Why is it that their spin frequency
is higher than the other? Which ones? The bursters? Nobody knows. It's not obvious why these guys stopped spinning. I mean, those radio pulsars are meant to be the descendants of the bursters when the accretion ends, but they're slower, maybe because they lived enough that, you know, the dipole radiation slowed them down. Who knows? But I don't care for the purpose of this talk. The fact is that they're rapidly spinning. And as I said, rapid spins have a number of effects in the light curves, and some of them are purely geometric and special relativistic. One special relativistic is obvious. When the spot is pointing towards you, the emission is blue shifted, so you see a different part of the spectrum and it's also boosted. When it's pointing away from you, the emission is red shifted, so you see a different part of the spectrum and it's boosted away from you. So if I have a star keeping everything the same, the black one, with a low spin, and I can't get spin at 600 hertz, then the Doppler shift are actually going to make the bright spot brighter and the faint spot fainter. So the spin frequency of the star, the fact that the star is spinning, is going to actually affect the amplitude, and that's something that you need to take into account, because remember, this is the amplitude that you measure to infer masses and radii. There's a geometric effect. The light crossing time across the neutron star becomes comparable to the spin of the neutron star. So the photons that come back from back here, as the neutron star spins, catch up with the photons that are emitted later on when the hotspot points towards here. So you have to take into account the time delays, which not only change a little bit the amplitudes, this is the effect of the blue, but also shift and change the harmonic content of that particular light curve. And these are relatively straightforward phenomena to take into account. And again, that's something that's been recognized for about 10 years now. But it's more important than that, and this is where GR comes into, that the space-time, the external space-time of a neutron star is something that is not Schwarzschild, is not Kerr, but something that is beyond that, right? Because the Kerr space-time for a fast-spinning object is a vacuum space-time, and a neutron star is not vacuum. And if you want to make a little table, and this is something that I usually show my friends from those missions, if you want to make a little table about what the characteristic space-times of neutron stars are depending on their spin frequency, and call them non-spinning, slowly spinning, moderate spinning, and fast spinning. And here I mean what I mean by those frequencies. And this is the maximum frequency for a particular space-time to be accurate within the 5%, which is the accuracy that we care about. Clearly, a non-spinning star, because of the Birkhoff's theorem, is spherical, Schwarzschild space-time, and the only thing that matters is mass of the radius. A slowly spinning star, the space-time is again unique, is the Kerr space-time. And now you need to worry about the mass, the radius separately, and the moment of inertia of the neutron star, because that determines the angular momentum for frame dragging. When you start going above 500 hertz, the star becomes oblate. The oblateness of the star is an omega square effect, right? Because it doesn't matter whether you spin this way or that way, so it's not linear in omega. And the space-time is again unique. It's the Hartle-Thorne space-time, which is not the Kerr space-time. And now it depends on the mass, the radius, the moment of inertia, the quadrupole of the star, and the polar to equatorial radius of the star, because that's where the surface looks like. And that's something that you need to use up to 800 hertz. And if you have an even faster spinning neutron star, then there's no good analytic expression for its space-time. You just have to calculate them, like put an equation of state, calculate, solve numerically the field equations, and figure out what the external space-time is. And that's a problem, because most of our sources are between 500 and 800 hertz spin frequencies. And therefore, we cannot just use, you know, Schwarzschild space-times, maybe with some special relativity on top of it, to measure their light curves if we ever want to infer masses and radii to better than 5 or 10%. And you're going to say, how significant are those effects? Well, this is how significant they are for the, space-time elements, but how about for the predictions? And one thing is that the surface, just the surface area of a neutron star, if you were to resolve it, suppose you had an infinitely amazing telescope like the kinds of that Avery was alluding to, and you want to resolve the how a neutron star will look like at very high spin frequencies, this is omega, by the way, it's not spin frequency, is that, first of all, the neutron star becomes oblate, and because of frame dragging, it becomes highly anisymmetric. And clearly, if the if you do not take into account the fact that in if surface is highly distorted, you're going to generate very different light curves. Not only that, but it turns out that the oblateness of the neutron star is by far the biggest problem. And here's a way to look at it. Again, flux as a function of phase for a particular configuration of a hotspot on a neutron star. Just look at those 90 degrees. This is the direction with which the observer is, the inclination of the observer, 30, 60, 90. The green light curve is what you would get using the correct space-time, but assuming that the surface of the neutron star is purely spherical. The dust blue curve is what you would get using the Kerr space-time, not Hartle-Thorne, not the correct space-time, the Kerr space-time, taking into account the oblateness, the correct oblateness of the neutron star. And the red curve is the complete space-time and the complete oblateness. And what you see is that for, this is 600 hertz again, that the oblateness introduces a 30% effect in the amplitude of the oscillations. Our goal is to measure mass and radius to 5%, few percent. We cannot not take into account the fact that those stars are oblate. And you, by the way, the oblateness is only of the order of 10%. You will see it in a second. because even a 10% of lateness leads to a 30% error in the amplitude of the oscillations that you're measuring. So the goal about last year, when after those missions actually were put together, all those proposals put together, seemed to be impossible. Because you're going to have an observed light curve, extremely accurate, and you have to infer 8 parameters, right? The mass of the star, the radius of the star, but that's not enough because they're fastly spinning, the oblateness, the moment of inertia, the quadruple moment of its space-time, if you want to do anything better than spectroscopic, and then the size of the hotspot and the two geometric effects. Is there 8 numbers that you can distill out of that light curve? Are there, if you do a harmonic analysis of that light curve and put the limitation from your counting statistics, can you measure at least 8 harmonics of that light curve? And the answer is no. There's no way. You can at most measure 4, as I will show in a second.
Do you really need the size
of this spot? So if you do it, and I will say that in a second, if you go early enough that the spot is less than about 20 degrees, then the size of the spot drops out. It doesn't really matter. The effect is marginal. But 7 parameters left. So how do you do? Well, you know, when this is like engineering, right? I'm not used to doing GR to do things like that. But at the end of the day, if you want to use data, you have to make compromises. And one of those compromises comes from the fact that the neutron stars are not that different, you know, 10 to 15 kilometers, depending on the equation of state. And they have significantly different predicted radii. But the moment of inertia is 1 order higher, the quadruple is 2 orders higher. And the quadruple of the various neutron stars depend more or less on the mass and the radii, and rather weakly on the equation of state. And the Hartle-Thorne expansion, the Hartle-Thorne approximation, gives you some ideas, if you do a Taylor expansion effectively, what the dependence is. So what we did with Michi this year, actually last year, is we calculated particular quantities as expected from the Hartle-Thorne formalism. This is the polar to the equatorial radius, and this is M over R, for various equations of state. So this is effectively the oblateness, how the oblateness depends on the mass to radius ratio. And we came up with fitting formulas. So these are the parameters that are derivatives in the Taylor expansion and the Hartle-Thorne formalism. And we measured them trying to fit the particular equations of state that we know, which cover a pretty wide range. And what we could do is we could actually predict moments of inertia, quadruples, and oblateness of the neutron stars to better than 2% for all the equations of state that we know. As I said, this is just a Taylor expansion, and we use the numerical calculations in order to calibrate that Taylor expansion, to calculate those derivatives. Now, the effect is a 30% effect at most in the light curves, and we can calibrate that effect to 2%. So effectively, we can take care of all the higher order effects in the spacetime to better than 1%, just by using those fitting formula. But even that leaves us 5 parameters: mass, radius, size of the spot, collatitude of the spot, and observer's inclination. And for reasons that we just talked, we can get rid of 1 just by focusing on when the spot is extremely small. Are there 4 quantities that we can measure out of the light curves? And the reason that that is not obvious is what GR does to you, as I said, is that it suppresses variability. But what it suppresses more clearly is the higher harmonic, suppresses the nth harmonic much faster than it suppresses the n minus 1 and suppresses the n minus 2 in the variability. And if you have a slowly spinning neutron star, you effectively get, with some exceptions, a single number, a single harmonic. The light curves of a slowly spinning neutron stars are almost always purely sinusoidal, because the strong gravitational lensing for most neutron stars, most neutron star equations of state, suppresses all the other harmonics way below what Loft is going to measure. And the way to see that is, this is the amplitude, this is mass and radius. These are contours of constant amplitude, 10%, 12%, 14%, and so on, for a slowly spinning neutron star at 1 hertz. And you see the only thing that they measure is M over R. And this is a condor, this is an honest-to-God condor, of the ratio of the second harmonic to the fundamental of the light curve, with showing only the things that Loft can detect, after having 1 million photons per light curve. The punchline is that the ratio of the harmonic to the fundamental is less than 10 to the minus 3. So there's nothing that you can measure. This is an actual condor plot. So if the neutron stars were slowly spinning and we didn't have to worry about this higher order effect, then we would never be able to make the measurement. What helps is the fact that the neutron stars are spinning and are spinning fast. And it's those Doppler shifts that I talked about, those time delays, the oblateness of the neutron star, that actually start introducing asymmetry back again, not because of the presence, not because of gravitational lensing, but because of all the other energy-dependent phenomena, introduce asymmetry that not only break the M over R degeneracy here, but start introducing a few percent, 4 to 10% ratios of the fundamental to harmonic, of the second harmonic to the fundamental. Yes?
Can you get to some of these numbers, at least independently, for us to double-check through our observations?
The mass and radii? Yeah. So for these particular sources, you have those other measurements that I showed you, the spectroscopic, which are within 10% in radius, so hopefully they will agree. But here we try to beat those observations. That's the idea, try to get better. But even that is not enough, right? We have four parameters and we have two measurements. You can make a million photons in your light curve, but ZR suppresses your higher order harmonics, period. Right? There's nothing you can do about that. But there's one more phenomenon that actually helps us pick two more parameters. And this is the fact, as I showed you, that because of Doppler boosts, the spectrum, the color of the spectrum that you measure, depends on whether the spot is pointing towards you or whether the spot is pointing away from you. And what you can do is you can calculate a color. And by color in X-rays is we take a spectrum, we split it, say, at 2 kV. We measure all the photons above 2 kV, all the photons below 2 kV, and take the ratio. The bigger the color, the harder the spectrum. And if you plot, this is the flux from that particular simulation, and this is the color. And what you see is that the color itself has an amplitude, how red it is here compared to how blue it is there, but also the peak of the color is displaced with respect to the flux. And that's easy to see because if it was a purely Newtonian neutron star, the flux will peak when you sit down the entire spot pointing towards you, so at zero phase, say, because that's the highest emissivity, and the color will peak at 90 degrees because that's the highest Doppler boost towards you. Now, as the neutron star unfolds, because of gravitational lensing, then those two peaks move around and actually they become closer and closer together. And as you crank up the mass of the neutron star, then the two peaks become closer and closer together. If I change the radius of the neutron star of a non-spin frequency, the amount of Doppler shift becomes bigger and the amplitude of the color increases. So the amplitude of the color oscillation and the phase shift between the color oscillation and the flux oscillation are two other distinguishing parameters that you can measure if you have energy dependence to the light curve. And this is how the amplitude of the color oscillations measures effectively radius. This is lines of constant amplitude. This is radius in kilometers. And as I said, for a given spin frequency, if I change the radius of a neutron star, I change the velocity v equals omega r fundamentally. And by changing the velocity, I change the magnitude of the Doppler boost, which is the whole region of the color. And what the phase difference measures is primarily the mass at the radii of interest, because that measures how unfolded the neutron star surface is on the image plane. So these are two additional parameters that you can measure out of energy-dependent light curves, and that became very important because it means that we need to be able to keep at this high timing resolution the energy information of the photons in those missions. And if you plug everything in, get a million photons in a light curve, and this is something that was the best that we expect to get from something like LOFT, three different neutron stars with three different masses in radii, fold it in, calculate the one sigma or 68% error ellipses that you expect, and these are the kind of measurements that you're going to see. So in some ways, we started by relying on the fact that general relativity affects the observed amplitudes, which was good, that's why those missions were designed. Then we realized that the sources that we have were spinning really rapidly. So if we want to do better than what we had before, we had to take into account those annoying rotational effects. But it turns out that those annoying rotational effects, those annoying ZR and special relativistic effects, are what actually help us break the degeneracies that ZR introduces because it suppresses all the harmonics unless those annoying effects happen there. So if you were to look back, the only way that you can make those measurements is with neutron star spinning beyond 400 hertz, and you will never be able to make it, even if you could, even if you knew sources like that, with neutron stars that were like garden variety pulses that are spinning at the hertz, way too slowly spinning. So this is where we are right now, and this is what goes into the or went into the second stage mission proposals. I think it's pretty safe to say, because we know the sources, we know how bright they are, we know all their phenomenology, people know all their phenomenology, and when to look for them, that there's at least two types of sources, especially the bursters for the case of LOFT, that have the phenomena that we need in order to measure the masses and radii of neutron stars within a few percent. The fact that those sources rapidly spinning are both, we thought originally were bad news, it turns out to be a wonderful news. And not only that, but we can actually quantify for the first time the exact requirements that we need that affect the kind of specifications for the designs of the instruments in order to achieve the goals that we're looking for and constrain the equation of state of neutron stars. I might stop here. Thank you.
What's the error that you expect to measure from the measurement of radius and mass?
So this is the
kilometer?
It's about 6%. So 0.6 of a kilometer, 0.7 of a kilometer. I mean, depends where you are. This is what the spectroscopic measurements suggest right now, 10, 11 kilometers. Something that is going to be interesting, I mean, for this particular simulation, we assumed this equation of state AP4, which is the equation of state that was used extrapolating a little bit the parametric fit to nuclear scattering data. So this is the best case scenario as far as nuclear physics is concerned. If you look back at the what the current spectroscopic measurements show, here they are. Even though each one of them has relatively big error bars, they're all concentrated. If you put one on top of the other, they're all concentrated at 9.5 kilometers. And actually, the best bet given current measurements for the radii of neutron stars is below 10 kilometers, which is not the most comfortable for nuclear physics. And when you do the inversion for what the pressure of the nuclear equation of state is, this is AP4, the one that most people favor this time around. This is a three sigma error. You're way above the factor of two, the three sigma error in third for the pressure as a function of density. What would that mean, even though here it agrees with it, is that you probably have more degrees of freedom that pop out at higher densities, perhaps a transition to quark gluon plasma. And if this turns out to be a precise measurement, that would be superb for nuclear physics, because there's no other way to probe that regime. It's cold superdense matter that you cannot do in an accelerator in the early universe. So there is a lot of, not only astrophysical motivation, but there's also, fundamental physics motivation to make that measurement. And the current data seem to indicate that there's more that we can learn than what we know right now.
So some people have talked about X-ray polarization.
Mm-hmm.
How much would that improve? I mean, first it would tell you something about the structure of the neutron star atmosphere. But then, that's something that's gonna vary in a well-defined way as a spot orbit. So that gives you a whole other hammer.
Correct.
Spend on.
They cannot do X-ray polarization, yeah. No, silicon drift detectors will never do polarization. So you're going to get most of polarization if you have a strong magnetic field on the neutron star. And a lot of the information people expect to get out of polarized measurements, if GEMS flew, for example, another NASA mission that probably is not going to fly, they would probably try to infer something about the, magnet atmospheres, like 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 Gauss neutron stars. You do expect a polarization signature from a non-magnetic neutron star just because it's scattering dominated atmosphere, but it's not, and also it's very short. It's like a fraction of a second, and you cannot integrate for the long time that you would need, like in the case of a pulsar, to measure anything like that. So it's not something that's going to happen. Yes, all the sources are totally known. The NICER is a very cheap mission, very inexpensive mission, and in order to get enough count rate, it's going to have to sit on the sources for a very, very long time. So they have to have a very well determined, set of targets. Of course, there are going to be targets of opportunity. Something big pops up in the sky, they're going to turn. Loft, on the other hand, is a much more expensive and much more community-wide mission. A lot of what Loft is going to do is strong field ZR and testing the no-hair theorem, and we do a lot of work on that. Actually, the team is very heavily involved in that. I didn't want to talk about that part in the talk today, but Loft is primarily a strong field ZR mission. But non-field dynamical ZR, yes. Like highly variable, but non-dynamical ZR, correct. And but this is a much bigger mission. It's going to, the only way that can be approved is that if it can afford to support a much wider community. And therefore, that mission is going to look at pretty much everything in the sky, literally.
So what is competing against?
Many things. There is, well, I'll try to remember. So Plato is a mission that was downgraded from L after Juice was selected. And Plato is effectively Kepler's transit planet finder mission. There is another planet atmosphere mission. And I don't want to say Euclid, but I don't think that's true. So there's four of them. It used to be three, but now there's four. The selection for that will be in 2 years. But at the end of the day, we're all trying to make sure that what we know what can be achieved. But at that level, the decision is entirely political, so it's not about the science.
So, but you have two, three, at the 1 out of 4 chances, right? So you're at about 50%.
Assuming that, which is probably true, because that's probably how they select those.
If you talked a little bit about calibration,
I have a feeling that I'm recorded, right? I shouldn't say things like that.
It's recorded and streamed.
Yeah, and streamed, I like that, yeah. I'm not.
You're talking about calibration uncertainty. But about nicer, is it possible that since it's going to be on the ISS that they could do a better job of calibration? Or does it not
where was it? I put it back. In this particular case, it doesn't matter, and I forgot where I put it. There we are. In the case of the spectroscopic measurement, the calibration is crucial because what you want to measure is the absolute flux that comes from the source. The case for what we're doing, the only thing that we measure is relative amplitudes. So the calibration doesn't really matter to that level. I mean, it matters in some ways that if it's energy-dependent, messed up calibration, it's going to affect the color of the spectrum and everything. But we're not at that level. So this is another way why we don't care. It's also distance-dependent, those measures, right? To do it spectroscopically, you measure the opening angle of the star, and you need to know how far away it is. And you can do it for sources in globular clusters because you have a relatively distance measurement to a globular cluster. In those dynamical ZR measurements, distance is irrelevant, right? I never said the word distance. The closer sources are better because they have more counts, but that's all there is to it. The distance drops out.
Is this variation due to variability in the craft, or is it due to variability in the calibration?
Both.
So then what time scale is the calibration doing? I mean, it must be longer than seconds.
I mean, this is, well, the question is, yes. So, but again, the calibration, the fraction here is of the order of a few percent, right? So.
Something I want to mention. You said that there was this one, the Morse measure of the neutron star mass is almost 2.
Well, there's 2 now,
there's
right?
There's one bigger than 2.
Yeah.
So Michael Kramer has.
Yeah, but for some reason people don't bring it up.
It just got accepted. I believe. But yeah, it is a 2.03, but the error bars are wider. So the peak value is higher, but the error bars are actually wider. The Morest method is entirely based on the Shapiro delay, so it's purely dynamical. The Max Planck result, which is also very believable, you need to know something about the mass of the white dwarf. So you measure a mass ratio, and they get the mass of the white dwarf from optical measurements. That's why the error bars are a little wider. And it's not purely ZR dynamical, like the Morest. Yeah, but there's at least 2 of them. I mean, that's not the problem. It's just doing atmosphere models for the white dwarf to measure the gravity of the white dwarf and everything else. But the 2 solar mass was beautiful because it got rid of the 1.4, 1.5 solar mass maximum masses. But the chances that we're going to get, I mean, if we get something at 3, that would be great, but you know, the chances that this will happen start diminishing quite rapidly.
So another thing, you talked a bit about the brightness of the star. So spin can have a large effect, but if we go about an hour towards Toronto, we'll run into this object to tell us about what kind of magnetic field this could have inside. We don't really know why green pulsars have low surface.
No.
But if you had 10 to the
17.
14 or 10 to the 16.
I think I remember the first author of that paper, right? when you involved in that, the neutron star equation of state.
Oh, yeah.
So that high super strong magnetic fields, yeah.
Oh.
in a previous life.
But
yeah.
The idea is that if you have these very strong fields, that can also potentially affect the internal structure.
Correct.
So, does that just get folded in with the general uncertainty? Or I guess it would be.
So here's the only way that this could affect you. In order to break the degeneracies, we have to assume that knowing the spin, the mass, and the radius of the neutron star, I can predict the ellipticity. And that is true, assuming that what causes that oblateness is, just the matter field for typical values of the equation of state. If what causes it is something else, like a very strong magnetic field, then this will be off. And the effect will go down to that 30%. So that is definitely true. Let's say that if we find, the chances that all the stars that we're going to see will have very similar internal magnetic fields will be rather unlikely. If you make many measurements, because we can probably do it for several neutron stars, if you make many measurements and are all over the place, then we're going to be really wondering about what the systematics are. If we make measurements that seem realistic and reasonable, then you start believing more what you're doing. And especially if you have different types of sources, if NICER and LOVE does it for totally different types of sources and they all agree, then we start believing a little more of what we're doing.
There was coming back to the fit that you showed where you can get the exactly. There was a paper on archive about 2 weeks ago or so by Nico Yunus where he derived some
correlations between the LOVE number and the quadruple of the neutron star.
Is that related?
Yes. Well, it's a different coefficient, but it's the same idea that the LOVE number measures the degree of deformability of a neutron star. So if I put in the degree of deformability, so if I put a neutron star in an external tidal field, like in the case of two neutron stars just before merging, then one neutron star is going to be tidally deformed. And how tidally deformed will be to linear order is proportional to the LOVE number, the degree of deformability, and the quadruple of the neutron star also measures, if I start spinning the neutron star, how deformed is it, right? So when people measure, when they try to measure the LOVE number and the quadruple of different neutron stars, they find them to be very tightly correlated as expected. As I said, unless you go to really high spin frequencies, what you're really doing is you're measuring coefficients of the Hartle-Thorne expansion. And what that number is, you don't know. You have to do it numerically, but you know that it's going to be more or less a constant number. It's just a coefficient. Which is good. I mean, there's actually a couple more papers doing similar things, and this turns out to be very important for things like LIGO, because again, when the sources that they're going to see coalescing, chances are they're going to be spinning pretty rapidly, and they want to make sure that they get all the deformabilities and all the quadruples and everything right for the ring down phase, or actually the initial.
Would be spinning pretty rapidly after the
merger. Even before.
Why?
Well, the double neutron stars that we know of, one, you're going to say it's a selection effect, but one of them is typically a millisecond pulsar, 10 millisecond, and the other is not.
Right, that
might be selection effect.
There are good reasons to think that not just might be, but
it will be.
Those things, you had to have had an epoch of mass transfer to get the second neutron star, right?
So, I don't like to talk astrophysics because it drives me nuts, but. Michael Kramer has this, one in a million argument, which I think is really important. Take the double pulsar, right? Suppose before double pulsar, you're writing a proposal and you say, we're going to find the double pulsar. You're going to be the joke of the community because the lifetime difference between the two pulsars is 1 in 1,000. One is 10 to the 6 years, the other is 10 to the 9 years. And the fact that you want one of the pulsars, first of all, both of them to point towards you, to see both pulsars. And the fact that one of them is actually practically 90 degrees, and you have to sit at 90 degrees inclination so that one eclipses the other, if you fold in those numbers, it's 1 in 1,000.
So I'm thinking back to you know, outer gap models and, you know, so Anatoly's. So I thought that those came from emission and current sheet. And so now, if instead of having a pole that has a point energy, now if I have a sheet that just has to sweep by you, that dramatically changes the statistics of how many poles are.
Correct, but still the inclination of the thing with respect to where you see is, you know, one over a few hundred. So really, one out of a million double neutron stars should have been the double pulsar. And we know five. So what's the chances that you're going to hit one in a million with five? You know, small number statistics, you're going to say, or we have no idea how to count, you know, how to count statistics and, you know, lifetimes and everything else. So unfortunately, when it comes to double neutron stars, it's you know, a lot of things are unusual. When you measure the masses of the two neutron stars in the double neutron star system and the five that we know, they're all the same to within less than 6%. And that gave the feeling that something is special about 1.4 solar masses, and there's nothing special about 1.4 solar masses, right? There's nothing in the system. 1.4 is a random number as it is 6.9, right? So why are all the systems 1.4 solar masses? And why all the double neutron stars are within that fraction? Actually, two of them, two double neutron stars, the masses in the pair are within 1 part in 1,000. So what is the chances that you're going to make two neutron stars, one of which is a millisecond pulsar, which means that it has accreted matter from two totally different supernovae, and make them within 1 part in 1,000 the same, with a mass that is a random number? There's really something that we do not understand about double neutron stars, or actually many things we do not understand about double neutron stars. And that's why I do not want to make any predictions about what it's, what is not.
What it is for LIGO, sources, where it starts are speeding fast or not, the impact on gravitational waves is very, very subtle. Especially given that LIGO will not catch the merger because it's beyond the pocket, then it's not playing a big role.
That's probably true. It's not for, the deformability and all of that is for the Einstein telescope, right? We're not going to get anything for deformability. The thought was that it might, but that's definitely the case. You're right. You're right. This is past advanced LIGO.
Well, unless we're talking about that,
it's a different story. You can deform it further away.
Do you have any other questions?
The analysis that you presented was mostly for LOT, right?
Yes, almost entirely. Yes, so people have done the NICER result without the breaking the degeneracy, because the good thing with NICER, I mean, it's a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing with NICER is that at least one of the sources has a very accurately measured mass because it's a member of a binary system. And the only thing that you need is measure M over R from the light curve, and that's it, because then you measure everything. So you don't have to worry about the breaking the degeneracy. The counter argument with NICER is that it is very difficult to make precise measurements on a source-by-source basis, because you don't know what the pattern of the emerging radiation is. And I think the best case for NICER would be is if you can measure from several sources and you find them to not be all over the place, then you know that the systematics cannot be bad. But measuring one will not help you. Correct. Correct. So that's why I was counting unit four measurements, and they identified four quantities that you can measure that you can actually help you break the degeneracy. And when you do this thing is taking everything into account with the realistic data.
Coming back to the binary discussion, most people have a binary neutron star. It's possible that you also produce the amount.
Double neutron stars? No. None that we know of that can be done. I mean, you're going to say one in a million. How do we know we're going to find double pulsar? if you find a millisecond pulsar that is emitting X-rays, and you can do it absolutely, especially if it's going to, in 10 years, it's going to coalesce, right? I mean.
Yeah, no, I work pretty most in the case that you have an open star, which is one of them, and the other is not one.
Which is like what most of them are.
Yeah, and you have these sort of techniques that we have seen connected, which in somehow will be able to produce this kind of a spot in the other.
The problem with that is that all the emission happens really far away from the neutron star, so you don't get any GR effects.
Yeah.
Any of them. No problem.